It is indeed a pleasure and honor for me this morning to introduce our keynote speaker today, this morning, Professor Vaughn Allen Lewis. And I'll give you just a short introduction on Professor Lewis. Professor Lewis is a native of St. Lucia, West Indies. He is Professor Emeritus of the University of the West Indies, having recently retired from the position of Professor, the International Relations of the Caribbean, at the Institute of International Relations of the University of the West Indies, St. Augustine Campus, Trinidad and Tobago. Over an academic career commencing in 1963, he served as Deputy Director of the Institute of Social and Economic Research, UE Cavill Campus, Barbados, and then as University Director of the Institute, which is now called the Sir Arthur Lewis Institute of Social and Economic Research at Mona, Jamaica Campus. Dr. Lewis also taught political theory and international relations in the Department of Government, UE Mona Campus, and also at the Universities of Wales, Swansea, Liverpool, Florida International University, and the University of Florida, Gainesville. Between these activities, he served from 1982 to 1990.
Section of studies discussed at a conference in 1957. And published in 1961 in a book edited by E.A.G. Robinson, was entitled The Economic Consequences of the Size of Nations. But as I emphasized, the main interest then was on how the small states of Europe, defined as having populations many times the number of our own countries, could themselves survive and sustain viable economic growth. From the perspective of the West Indies, the first decade or so of the independence experience seemed to suggest a controverting of the presumption that relatively small entities were unlikely to be, in the phrase of the time, viable. Jamaica, for example, the largest of the post-Federation states, the beneficiary of external demand for its bauxite and the growth of tourism, from the United States and the United Kingdom, experienced growth deemed to be acceptable, leading to suggestions by its officials that the country was moving into the ranks of middle-income countries. As the country's finance minister put it in 1968 at a meeting of the Inter-American Development Bank, with a hint of the need for new kinds of support to ensure further advances in the country's economic status, insufficient attention, and that was the then Minister of Finance, Edward Siaga, saying that insufficient attention was being given to countries not making much economic progress. Insufficient attention was being given to countries which had made economic progress, and instead the emphasis was being put on countries which had not made any economic progress. But yet he argued that when a country made a certain level of economic progress, it was necessary for new forms of assistance from the international community to come to it. As is well known, Singapore, unlike Jamaica, continued to experience persistent expansion and diversification of its economy, functioning as an autonomous entity within the wider international economy. Without the classic integration of many colonies into the British imperial preference system for their trade in agricultural commodities, Singapore was forced to contemplate new modes of economic organization and involvement in the general international economic system. The experience of Singapore will have given rise to some consideration of the terms under which countries not favored by their location in terms of proximity to countries of relatively similar size that might form a basis for economic integration, could make economic progress themselves. In this connection, we can note a particular study published in 1993 by Paul Streeton, a British economist generally sympathetic to the problems of ex-colonial developing countries, in which he discussed whether the drawbacks of small size can be overcome by economic integration. But he concluded that the experience in this regard is disappointing. He was, of course, speaking of countries like our own. That the presumption that we had held for many years, that economic integration was a mechanism or a method of enhancing the possibilities of economic growth, he argued, had not really been demonstrated to be true. It was not, however, until Britain's application for membership of the European communities that the issue of the long-term viability of the preference system came in for initial questioning, with West Indian officials, however, at first presuming that a new arrangement with the European community would guarantee the continuation of the preferential and protectionist scheme. As the then Minister of Jamaica, of Trade in Jamaica put it, his countries would be seeking from the United Kingdom, as it pursued negotiation for membership, bankable assurances of the fact of continuity. That statement indicated the level of confidence then held by our officials in the willingness of the British government to ensure the preservation of the systems of preference and protection which we had experienced. The United Kingdom government strategy, supported by France in respect of its own ex-colonies, for continued access to the British market, as elaborated in the now called African, Caribbean, and Pacific states, was formalized in the 1975 Lomé Convention, and it appeared to provide a satisfactory solution to the issue of the potential exclusion from a European community, including Germany, which was not particularly sympathetic to subsidies and preferences. But it took only 10 years for the ACP states to realize that the new systemic arrangements providing for their agricultural commodities, in particular sugar and bananas, would only be temporary, undergoing a new systemic challenge from the new WTO regime. Persistent entreaties by the ACP states to be looked at as special cases have come to naught. And indeed, Caribbean states, as others, have found that the pressure to bring all economic activities under that regime has not been extended to the new international services activities which they have established over the last decade and a half or so. In that context, too, these ex-colonial states have come to be classed with other small states, and in particular, the small European jurisdictions, for whom location and the advances in technology of communication had meant that with the establishment of services activities, extensive physical space was no longer necessary for economic advancement. So a Bahamas, a Barbados, or an Antigua and Barbuda have come in these circumstances to be classed with a Luxembourg or even a Switzerland, as the new trade in diverse types of financial and internet services has provided a base for relatively high per capita income. But in attaining that status, they have ceased to be perceived or categorized as strictly developing countries and obliged to fall under rules applying to advanced countries. Indeed, in the 1990s, comparisons began to be made between the so-called microstates of Europe, of Western Europe, and the microstates of the Caribbean, which had been able to advance the economic growth through involvement in services industries. Here, small size as a disadvantage in the process of development ceased to matter. The capabilities required to sustain economies based on trade and services are seen as disconnected from physical size, since it is presumed that at a certain level of economic activity, these capabilities or the qualifications which they require are available on the international market. In addition, the concept of security, meaning the provision of safe and confidential arrangements taken as necessary for the pursuit of these activities, is similarly not seen as deriving from size, but from good governance. The same line of argument is increasingly said to apply to the service of tourism in developing countries. Size, again, is not seen as relevant to economic growth, being replaced again by the intangible notion of security. This time, security meaning, or being defined as the capacity of a small state and its citizens to provide an atmosphere devoid of the threat of criminality or criminal violence of any major kind. Another aspect of good governance. In some quarters in that decade then, a certain optimism about the prospects for small states' economic growth prevails, as is evident in the title of a paper by William Easterly and Art Cray, Small States, Small Problems? Growth and Volatility in Small States. One perspective was that the problems experienced by certain small states and the Jamaica of the late 1970s into the 1980s, for example, tended to be seen as a particular case in that regard. That the problems they experienced were due to errors of policy rather than to the objective consequences of their size or disruptions in their relevant international environments. In this era of extensive influence of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, the emphasis was placed on putting in place appropriate policy variables and adjusting the factors of production to the requirements of an open and liberalized international economic system. From this perspective, then, the discourse on the prospects for small state viability, as this was related to the limitations of small size, either physical or population, tended to lose some of the salience which developing country economists had suggested it had. These systems were not seen as demonstrating significant success in terms of economic growth and welfare over time. It was not accepted in international policy circles that the externally induced recessions that overtook Latin America and the Caribbean in the era now referred to as the lost decade could themselves account for the failures of the integration systems in developing countries in general. So there's a shift in thinking, a shift in the, as we call it, the conceptual apparatus that we were using to apply, or that was being used to apply to the possibilities for success or failure of states. It was no longer acceptable for us to argue that because we were small, we experienced certain deficiencies that would inhibit growth. The international economists and the international institutions preferred to tell us that our deficiencies of growth were due to bad policies. In a sense, it was in response to this that in the discourse on small state growth, there began to be a focus on the issue of the ability of small entities to develop instruments and policies that would provide them with what came to be referred to as resilience in response to their admitted vulnerability. This work, emanating from university scholars and policymakers in the small island state of Malta, identified itself as a developing state, but situated in the Western European physical environment. This work has had a focus not simply on the weaknesses or instabilities deriving from small size, but on the kinds of policy instruments that would permit the development of alternative capabilities permitting the small state to maneuver. This work coincided with two events. The first was the desire of both Malta and Cyprus to seek integration into the European community, work that culminated after Malta's application to join in 1990 with its actual accession to the community. This not only placed on the agenda of the European Union the issue of large differences of size between some states and others, likely to become members of the community, but it now brought in the issue of the potential acceptance of developing microstates. The second event with which Malta was also associated was the 1994 United Nations Barbados Declaration on small island states. This sought to give the small states issue a more definitive particularity by defining island states as having a specific vulnerability, inherent and not simply contingent on varying circumstances, and therefore to relaunch the issue of the variety of characteristics identified with small island states that define that vulnerability in particular ways. As the Maltese scholar Briguglio and his co-authors put it, I quote, "When measuring vulnerability, we are not measuring power. We are measuring exposure to external forces outside one's control. Small island developing states are inherently vulnerable, and nothing much can be done about that reality. However, small island developing states should be helped to take measures to become more resilient and become better able to cope with that vulnerability." And he goes on to say, "In spite of their economic vulnerability, many small states manage to generate a relatively high GDP per capita. Singapore," he says, "is not a poor country, but it is an inherently vulnerable country. It has built its resilience as a result of a deliberate policy. The Singapore paradox is the result of resilience, the extent to which an economy can withstand the negative effects of economic vulnerability on its economic development. Thus, vulnerable states should not be complacent in the face of their economic vulnerability." The authors seek to reaffirm that we can have inherently vulnerable countries that most, through suitable policies, have succeeded in strengthening their economic resilience. And so a shift again in the conceptual apparatus for dealing with the problem. That the problem is in a sense to be solved from internal creation of internal arrangements rather than dependence on the external environment or changes in the external environment to facilitate growth and the lessening of vulnerability. This discourse, with its attempt to introduce a new conceptual apparatus, sought, as it were, to confirm the dependence of small island states and their openness to vagaries of international economic systems and policies relating to them. But it sought, in part, to shift what we might call the focus of responsibility for coping with the state's fragility and vulnerability by seeking to define domestic policy measures needed to be taken by the victim state, so to speak. Subsequent research has identified SIDS, small island developing states, as fragile, prone to state failure or failures of appropriate governance, and overrepresented among countries classed as fragile states in the international system. The conclusions of the University of Malta studies might then be put in this way, that while recognizing smallness in its varying dimensions and the island character of small states as significant variables influencing their potential for economic development, they should not necessarily be treated as the dominant variables in determining viability or survivability in the local or international environment in which the state finds itself. Rather, the parallel influence of the other relevant variable, in particular the appropriate policy variable, should also be given a relevant weighting in analyzing or assessing the potential for building resilience. In turn, the discussion of the elements constituting appropriate resilience rests on the issue of finding appropriate policy choices and on a country's or a government's capacity to sustain the implementation of those choices. Thus, in the context of the given openness of small states, irreversible in normal circumstances without detriment to viability of the economy, resilience, as it is defined by the authors, is also identified with the coping ability of the affected states. It may, as Briguglio says, be also associated with adaptation. There has, of course, been much discussion of the extent to which the Singapore case can be taken whether in relation to its domestic or external relations policies, as exemplary for other small states. In addition, the question is raised of the specificity of its constitutional arrangements and mode of governance, by which is meant really the familiar argument that Singapore is in part an autocratic, has an autocratic mode of governance. And therefore, it cannot apply to our case where we have democratic, quote-unquote, modes of governance. Indeed, one acknowledged expert on the country's post-independence existence, in describing it as an exceptional state, has observed, I quote, that Singapore is best represented as sui generis, irrespective of its size. Correspondingly, given its accomplishments, it is not easy to locate Singapore comfortably within the overlapping category of weak states, which has succeeded small states as more pertinent in academic literature. One of our own academics, Caribbean academics, Winston Griffith, has also written on this question as to whether, as he puts it, CARICOM can replicate the Singapore experience. But you'll see again the shift in the language and the shift in the mental approach to the subject, the conceptual approach to the subject, which takes the burden away from the notion of size and small size and transfers it to a domestic responsibility for finding ways of appropriate governance that will allow you to elaborate policies with a degree of consistency. What the discussion on vulnerability and the provisions on construction of capabilities for resilience has done, however, is, as I'm saying, in some measure to shift the discourse and its vocabulary away from the dominating character of the ever-present significance of dependency prevalent in the literature of the 1970s. The emphasis is one that focuses on the ability to adapt, since from a systems perspective, dependency is a normal aspect of the arrangements of living systems. The emphasis shifts, therefore, the provision of capabilities capable of adaptation to the provision of capabilities capable of adaptation in varying settings, the particular instrument to decisively change the context in which much of the trade of Caribbean countries was being conducted. The global economic arena now began to take on the character of a series of liberalized economic spaces, whether through the establishment of the European single market and economy and the beginning of its spread to the countries of the former Soviet Union, or on the other side of the Atlantic, the determination of the United States to create a free trade area of the Americas, either as a single entity encompassing all countries of the hemisphere, or as a series of free trade area agreements with individual countries or groups of countries. In that context, such comparative advantage in their trade that Caribbean countries had hoped to maintain with both the European Union and with the United States through the Caribbean Basin Trade and Production Act was no longer permitted to exist, as the specialized preference arrangements gave way to generalized preferences applicable to all countries. This process has been leading, from a Caribbean state's perspective, to a situation of dissolution of what were expected to be the new protective arrangements for them, even within the liberalized international economic space. The establishment of AOSIS aimed at implementing the Barbados Declaration meant, from the point of view of negotiating capability, a de facto separation of these states from the wider ACP system, in itself not significant, since the new design of the European Union would have the effect of regionalizing its trade relations with its ACP associates, and the consequent marginalization of the ACP system as a diplomatic arena for negotiating positions on the part of European ex-colonial states. So the new liberalization of the economy emanating both from Europe on the one hand and the United States on the other has the effect really of dissolving the instruments that were created for negotiating and assuring a place for developing countries, the so-called ACP countries. For the effect of all of that was de facto to dissolve the ACP as an effecting negotiating instrument. On the other hand, the not dissimilar set of negotiations by the United States for establishing free trade areas with separate states or separate groupings of states forced the CARICOM states into negotiations separately with the United States and Canada, segregating them institutionally in that sphere from other Caribbean states, in particular the Dominican Republic, which had now become a member of the CARIFORUM, and subsequently linked together with CARICOM in the new economic partnership agreement with the European Union. So in other words, no sooner had we found a way of, reluctantly, admittedly, of drawing the Dominican Republic into a wider Caribbean negotiating sphere, the attraction to the free trade area arrangement pulled them away from us and therefore segregated the possibilities of negotiating it. From all of this, two questions arise. The first being whether the EPA, Economic Partnership Agreement, is likely to affect the process of Caribbean regional economic integration as intended. And the second, whether in fact the space designed as a CARICOM, CARIFORUM arena for economic integration has any longer relevance in the context of the new relationships induced by the redrawing of relations between both the European Union and the Caribbean states on the one hand, and the design for trade liberalization implied in the United States hemispheric free trade agenda. On the first of these issues, a substantial discussion was opened up during the course of the EPA negotiations and after the signature of the CARIFORUM EPA agreement by, for example, the economists Norman Govan and Havelock Brewster. This led in the context of the signing of the agreement between the EU and CARIFORUM countries that there should be a review of the functioning of the agreement within a specific time period. In other words, the agreement having been signed and sealed, the criticisms of its nature now led to an understanding that it could be reopened in the future, and therefore the sense of permanence lost. That criticism is reflected also in an observation entitled, "Europe is Sacrificing Caribbean Interests for Improved Relations with Latin America," by David Jessop, the director of the Caribbean Council, an individual essentially sympathetic to the EPA agreement as it came into being. And this he said, since 2006, Europe has been negotiating bi-regional association agreements with Central American and Andean nations. These wide-ranging agreements contain detailed provisions for free trade that will provide Peru, Colombia, and the nations of Central America, after a short transition, the same levels of access to Europe that the Caribbean has. So whereas we thought that by signing a new agreement, we would have some kind of understanding of a certain level of openness to our own products, we find the Europeans subsequently giving the same concessions to others. And that, of course, is the meaning of the notion of one international economic liberalized states, no longer segregated by the various powers of the world. It had been recognized for some time by analysts that the United States' initiative to establish a free trade area of the Americas had induced a response from Europe that would ensure that the European Union was able to establish a modernized presence in the hemisphere, and particularly on the South American continent. The settlement of the Uruguay Round, coinciding with the establishment of the EU single market and economy, reinforced this objective, and a general wider objective on the part of the European Union to rationalize its relations with different parts of the hemisphere. This meant, in turn, forcing a rationalization of its relationship with the Caribbean economic integration system, based in part on an expectation that our subregion would be also required to find an appropriate location pursuant to the already existing Caribbean Basin Initiative with the United States. That what they were trying to do in relation to the hemisphere, we would have to reopen and try to do similarly from our location and vantage point. The onset of the World Trade Organization was to hasten this basic European orientation further. The significance for the CARICOM being not only the insistence of the Latin American states, strongly supported by the United States, that the rationalization of the EU-ACP banana trade should be brought to a firm conclusion that recognized the right in the era of global liberalization of all producers to equal access to all markets. And the agreement this year on an EU-Latin American arrangement on bananas deemed compatible with the WTO agreement reflected an even wider conclusion about generalized free trade. This was the WTO decision in 2004 at the instance of, among other country states, Brazil, that there should be no difference in the terms applying to the trade in sugar with the United Kingdom and Europe and other purchasers or exporters. The significance of this for CARICOM lay in the effect of this decision on the sugar exports to the United Kingdom of Guyana in particular, a situation which induced the government of Brazil to seek to give assurances to Guyana of support for arrangements that would permit compatibility without undue harm to Guyanese exports and ensure diversification in the use of sugar. What in fact they said was, we are going to have open access as you have had open access over all these years, but never mind. We will help you to develop the productivity of your sugar, and in any case, we will let you, we will show you how to develop the product of petro, what is it called again? The derivatives from sugar that can be used in agriculture, the fertilizer derivatives. We will help you to arrange those, so we'll put ourselves on an equal footing. The onset of the subsequent to this, there have been attempts on the part of Brazil to propose infrastructural linkages with Guyana. These would create new combined spaces for economic development between the two countries, and restructuring which would provide Guyana with new arenas for economic growth. We have suggested elsewhere that the Brazil interest in its northern South American neighbors, Guyana and Suriname, is likely to grow over time on the basis of the Brazilian Initiative for Regional Infrastructural Development in South America. This initiative advocates that new cross-country physical integration arrangements for economic growth are likely to be the most productive economic and growth platforms in the future. This will naturally give Guyana a two-pronged integration stance, with that country seeking to establish relationships with both CARICOM and the wider integration initiatives proceeding in South America. The same might be said to apply to Belize, in its location proximate to Mexico and the Central American states, whose integration agreement Belize has already acceded to, thus having itself again a dual integration stance. The questions arising then are threefold. First, whether given differences in resources for economic transformation, the countries, Guyana and Suriname on the one hand, on the southern flank of the Caribbean community, and Belize on the western flank, will be more attracted in the medium term to integration arrangements designed by their much larger counterparts there than to the arrangements proposed by CARICOM itself. Next, CARICOM countries, as small and microstates, have perceived their process of regional integration in a geographic space considered to be a particular culture sphere, as an instrument for reducing fragility and therefore vulnerability, and therefore, in addition, enhancing their capabilities for coping with increasingly complex external environments. This enhancement of collective capabilities would be intended to reinforce the effective sovereignty of specific small-sized member states, where sovereignty implies the capacity to manipulate complex systems as they evolve in our relevant international environment without falling into one or other form of subordination. The purpose of the movement to a single market and economy was to achieve this objective through increasing the cohesion of a single economic space, as well as necessarily the cohesion of its governance system. The second question arising in this context then is whether the stretching of the geographical boundaries of the existing CARICOM integration system would have the effect of weakening its coherence as specific states extend their capabilities and resources towards integration with third states on their boundaries. In a practical sense, the question would be, does one or other state have available the instruments for effective participation in multiple integration systems? The third question arising would be whether, with the evolution of the liberalization of the external economic arrangements, which provided a certain security and predictability for CARICOM member states individually and collectively, the relevance of the present CARICOM integration configuration would come into question. Already with the establishment of the CARIFORUM and then of the CARIFORUM EPA agreement, the European Union had indicated a desire to see the larger states of the Dominican Republic and Haiti encompassed within an expanded Caribbean single market and economy. The integration of Haiti, accepted in part because it could be deemed to be historically part of the Caribbean, the CARICOM culture sphere, has had to be partial and time-framed towards fuller coherence for reasons that we know. At the same time, however, the general commitment of both Haiti and the Dominican Republic to a WTO trade and production process common to all Caribbean countries, and the possibilities of a liberalization of the Cuban economy over time, suggest synergies in economic development among the greater Antilles of the Caribbean, which would induce Jamaica to promote the extension of the single market and economy to those countries. This discussion would therefore appear to come to focus on the extent to which the conceptual apparatus defining the limits and possibilities of our regional integration system in terms of its potential for sustaining the economic and cultural and administrative cohesion and enhanced growth, that conceptual apparatus which states have kept as particular to themselves ought to be considered potentially inappropriate in their emerging geopolitical and geoeconomic environments. Further, from a domestic, that is, sub-regional perspective, the long hiatus, beginning with the CARICOM government's difficulties in finding consensus on an appropriate mode of governance to maintain the cohesion of a single market and economy, having rejected the recommendations of the West Indian Commission, it is not clear to many observers that a new conceptual apparatus for defining what is required and acceptable in terms of governance can be readily achieved. Put another way, a formula for institutionalized collective action meant to enhance individual sovereignty and thus maintain autonomy vis-a-vis other sub-regional arrangements appears for CARICOM so far impossible and extremely difficult to attain. The challenge of establishing new instruments for collective management of an integration system intended to ensure that the constitutional sovereignty of individual states is assured through a reduction of their de facto vulnerability in the new environment has not been met by, in the first instance, a new conceptual framework acceptable to all CARICOM participants. But the new environment is evolving at a pace prescribed by entities larger than the CARICOM states and within the CARICOM sphere itself. These entities are able to influence the wider Caribbean environment, particularly as, whether in the case of the larger states of Brazil and Mexico, or the Central American states or the Dominican Republic, they are moved to establish wider systems with the major countries influencing trade relations in the hemisphere. Our conclusion, then, that our concept of CARICOM, as it has evolved, with its weaknesses in cohesion and governance, imply a certain difficulty in maintaining our coherence, and therefore an inclination on the part of one or other state of CARICOM to seek other arrangements to ensure the minimizing of their vulnerability. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Prof. Lewis. I think you've given us a lot of food for thought in this presentation this morning. We now have to adjust our thinking, the whole rethinking our conceptual frameworks and modes of governance that are for a geopolitical environment that would be relevant to what is happening today. It's now 10:06, and we're supposed to end for 11, but I've been told that if we do end before 11, we'll get a treat. Well, I don't know if it's a treat per se, but there'll be a short film on Hurricane Thomas and what it's done to St. Lucia. So if we do finish before 11, perhaps we could get to see that short film. So at this time, I'll take questions from the floor. I'll probably take a round of Okay, I'll take a round of three questions, then we'll come to the head table for the response, and then we'll probably go for a second round of three, if that works for everybody. Okay, so one question in the front here. Are there any others? Two, Jessica. A third question. Okay, so we'll go with those two for now, the gentleman and then Jessica.
Okay, my name is Sadiq Musa. I work in Multimedia University, Malaysia. Actually, I have comments and questions. Comparing Singapore with the Caribbean, I think Singapore is totally different. According to the location of Singapore, it has a strategical location. And Singapore, a country, has no resources at all. Although they don't have democracy, it is an autocratic regime focusing on business with Chinese mentality. And this is in Chinese, who benefit from Western country to educate their people, to use their technology, and to attract the foreign direct investment. All the development of East Asia, except South Korea and Japan, is almost 100% in direct foreign direct investment, from manufacturing even to the hyper market. These countries are getting these chances. I don't think you have this chance in Caribbean. And also Singapore is practicing transit export. Re-exporting. They are providing financial services also. So I think it's totally different than the Caribbean countries. And then my question is, the second question, to have an economic union or to have any economic body like ASEAN or EU, it should be comparative advantage. Comparative advantage. Every country has advantage in different resources. So what is the comparative advantage that can help the Caribbeans to have a union and also to have a free trade agreement with other countries? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Jessica?
Good morning. Professor Lewis, really quick question. What do you see as the future for CARICOM?
Thank you.
Well, I didn't want to be seen as advocating a Singapore solution. I was trying to speak of methodology in approaching a problem as distinct from the characteristics of the country. In the 1960s, one of the more famous development economists, whose name escapes me now, actually made a comparison between Jamaica and Singapore. In those years, there was not a substantial difference between them in terms of growth, economic growth. And he ended the argument by saying, we will see what happens over the next few years. Well, we know what happened in the case of Jamaica. And so the question that arises in our minds was, what went wrong? Was it that we got caught in a situation of dependency from which we could not escape? Was it that our small size did not permit us to effectively participate? That we, small size meaning that we couldn't develop the resources, human resources, to participate in international economy? Was it either of those? And the answer was, but those things apply also to other countries and apply to Singapore. And therefore, we had to shift our thinking simply from the concept of dependency, which prevailed in the 1960s, 70s, and so on. So the thinking began to evolve from taking as the independent variable the nature of external relations by itself, but linking that to the question of the nature of the domestic arrangements of any state or group of states. I made a reference at the end towards the Guyanese inclination to suggest, not Guyanese, the Brazilian inclination to suggest to its neighbors, and its smaller neighbors as well, that there is scope for what they call infrastructural integration, that is a physical integration that would allow for a wider space from which a country could operate in cooperation with another country, which of course is the meaning of integration. And I made reference also to the entry of Malta, which as we accept is in a European location, into the European Union. The issue being seeking a larger space for whatever economic activity you have, in order either to allow you to make the activity or to sell the activity. Somewhere in the 1990s, the Prime Minister of Dominica, the then Prime Minister of Dominica, Mr. Rosie Douglas, who was a socialist, whose party was a member of the Socialist International, he told his on an occasion when the president of France was visiting Martinique, he advised his Caribbean colleagues that he was going to ask the president of France to assist the integration of Dominica into the European Union. And everybody laughed. And his colleagues advised him not to do that. But he did it. But where you can see he was aiming at is finding a space that was more appropriate than the one that we were negotiating as either as ACP countries or in respect of the European single economy in order to reduce the vulnerability of the country in that new environment. That is not to advocate that Dominica should have gone into the European Union, but is to indicate that the countries, governments were forced to begin to rethink the options that are available to them. And it is from that perspective that I refer to Singapore. Singapore, of course, made a strategic decision in the 1960s after its expulsion from the Federation of Malaysia. And that was, it was a simple but complex decision, and that was to support the United States in the Vietnam War, which allowed them to open their country to manufacturing of simple things, uniforms and so on, to service the American expedition and to advance their manufacturing base, in recognition that that kind of activity would not be a perpetual activity. That even when you are successful in one sphere of economic activity, the changing external environment for small countries implies that you will have to respond when that activity comes under pressure from that external environment. And so that our thinking would have to change in two respects. What is the central notion that we're using? Whether it is dependency, whether it is CARICOM integration. I use the word the CARICOM being a kind of a unit because the countries have the same culture sphere, which is a strong element in the approach of CARICOM to other countries, even in the Caribbean, from the point of view of integration. Whether those notions are suitable to a changed environment is a question, and whether we therefore have to rethink the mental framework which we're using is the relevant one. The future, CARICOM, you asked about a future in CARICOM. CARICOM is not dissimilar in a sense to a number of other countries experiencing very different kinds of integration processes. As I'm sure you know, there's a long, elaborate discussion going on in Southern Africa on the nature of that integration system, one in which, of course, there is what we might call a pivotal state of South Africa, but in which countries still wish to observe and preserve a certain degree of autonomy. The CARICOM, of course, has had a series of studies, which, for whatever reason, the recommendations of which our governments have not been able to agree on. And I think the first lesson is that you have to agree on something. You cannot not agree with everything, which is the situation of our CARICOM governments at the present time. That all the proposed solutions evolving over 20, 30 years, there has never been an ability to come to a consensus on one or other accepted solution. And so there's a stasis, and that is what, of course, the external people perceive, a difficulty in arriving at consensus on any single approach to CARICOM integration. If that is not resolved, then we cannot proceed. So my lecture has a certain pessimism, as you probably observed.
Are there any other questions? Okay, yeah.
Not that I am aware. In that article I referred to by Griffith, he discusses some of that on whether we can replicate the Singapore model. He discusses some of that, but the lesson, in a sense, from that country, is not a lesson in physical things. It is a lesson in how we come to conclusions about any one thing or another. Now, if you say that is a lesson, the criticism of that
was that Singapore had an autocratic system of governance, democratic in form, but autocratic in practice. Mm-hmm. But then, if you single out that variable, we see Guyana had an autocratic government for many years, but it didn't come to that evolve in the way of the other country. Right? So to try and single out specific variables and treat them as dominant variables is not in itself a satisfactory way of proceeding. The foundation of Singapore's independence meant that a regional solution was not thinkable as a viable solution. It had been expelled from the Malaysian Federation, and its neighbors, Malaysia and Singapore and in Indonesia for many years, were hostile. And therefore, the country had to think of jumping over, as it were, the boundaries of its region, of its sub-region. And there is, in that statement that I read from Mr. Owen Arthur, the former Prime Minister of Barbados, something of that thinking as our countries have evolved, that the original intention being that in CARICOM trade, the development of trade within CARICOM would create a foundation for further capability for manufacturing and exports into the wider world. That is not an appropriate methodology anymore. And that if you speak of a CARICOM integration system, it is as a system, it is as a platform for coping and dealing in the international community, particularly if you are dealing in different kinds of services. And therefore, the question of size and the question of dependency, which have been, for a large part of our independent existence, dominant questions influencing how we approach economic growth, that thinking of ourselves would suggest to me that those are seen not as relevant as they might have been in an earlier period. And that the question is, what are the instruments that one needs to create and manipulate in order to be able to operate from a wider physical platform in the international sphere itself?
I have a question. Closer to home, what lessons can CARICOM learn from the OECS states? And how do you think, for example, Trinidad wanting to have a closer tie with the OECS states, how do you think something like that would affect the functioning of CARICOM, if at all?
The recent experience of the OECS states in the economic sphere, in the context of the global recession, in the context of regional recession, that experience suggests to us that the possession of the financial instrument, the currency union, is a critical element in holding against the demise of the financial system. I'm talking about CLECO and British American and all of that, and the recession that developed. In other words, the OECS as an economic system is not a highly integrated economy. The OECS as an economic system is not one in which there is a substantial interchange of trade, let us say, between St. Lucia and Antigua. In the early phase, the OECS countries developed manufacturing on the basis of investment from abroad for the wider CARICOM market. That phase is over. The question is how to make economic policy that will be able to operate on the basis of a consensus and instruments that can maintain that consensus because they are critical to the functioning of the of each economy, each single economy. And that was really what happened in the... So you will see that there's still a scrambling in Trinidad and Tobago going on about the CLECO and so on. But a methodology was put in place to ensure two things, because coincident with the recession and coincident with the CLECO matter was the decline in the economies of, for example, Dominica and Antigua. Yet what was done was to use the currency union, the currency union system, as a means of giving assurances to the international community that there was a degree of stability in which those countries in crisis were operating, so that their individual well-being would be a function of the collective stability of the system as a whole. And I think that is an important lesson. It's an important lesson in terms of what has happened in the last 30 years or so relating to the currencies of other countries in the region. That when these crises occurred, there was no wider foundation which could give assurance to the international community that environmental stability could be maintained in such a way as would be helpful to the country in crisis. We can compare it to what is happening in Europe today, and the situation of Ireland, which people call a small country in Europe, and eventually the situation that Ireland has come to is to accept that the foundation of its individual stability would be a function of its location within the wider sphere, the currency union of Europe. So I think that in the case of the OECS, the maintenance of the currency union has been an important aspect of the survival of these very fragile economies over the years.
If there are no more questions, I think we could thank Professor Lewis once more for his presentation, and we could end at this time. I think we're supposed to have a short film now, presentation. Some housekeeping matters while we wait.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Number one, okay, those who have just arrived today, I'm Alam Ahmed from WASD. I know some of those might not see me, but I think there's a question going on I'd like to clarify. I'm just going to make use of any small 1-2 minutes available to highlight this. Publications, because that's very important for all of us. We need to publish our work. Now, the way we do at WASD, and we are proud of that, our proceeding is very, is a refereed proceeding, as you have seen it. The corrections, the amount of corrections you have been asked to do. I think I should stop here, because I think it's, are you ready, Ethan?
Yeah.
Yeah. I will carry on, don't worry, after that. We just want to make sure.
It all started on Saturday, October 30th, 2010, from about 9 a.m., intensifying for a full 24 hours. When the rain finally stopped, it was the morning of Sunday, October 31st. By that time, all radio stations were knocked off the air. there was a deafening silence from some parts of the island, cut off completely by the storm. As daylight unfolded, the evidence became clear.
I was there, I saw, and I couldn't believe it. Because all of the whole eel and mini come down, heard it sweep into Lakuan, and that is just a bad village.
Tout côté qui était ni la rivière à les monde descend ta fait la falaille. Il t'en coinche.
But my concern right now is not for the dead. I sympathize, I understand. But my concern is for the living that may become dead.
Hurricane Tomas was going to be etched in the history of St. Lucia as the most devastating storm to hit the island in recent times.
With our preliminary assessments coming from the various agencies regarding the damage caused and the cost for reconstruction is in the vicinity of US $500 million, which is a sizable amount.
Hurricane Tomas was an extreme rainfall event. The island's steep slopes, already weakened by a drought earlier in the year, could not withstand over 24 hours of non-stop rain. The St. Lucia Meteorological Office reports that the George F. L. Charles Airport in Castries reported 533 millimeters or 21 inches of rain. Huonora Airport in Beaufort recorded 593 millimeters or 23.4 inches of rain. The Dewash Automated Weather Station at the top of Fonse Jacques in Soufrière, the community hardest hit, recorded 668 millimeters of rainfall, or 26 inches of rain, from 4 a.m. on Saturday to 3 a.m. on Sunday. On average, St. Lucia recorded an inch of rainfall every hour. The St. Lucia Meteorological Service says that rainfall from Hurricane Tomas exceeded Debbie, the last big rainfall event in 1984, by 100 millimeters. Within hours of the storm, the extent of the damage became obvious. In Castries, the shock bridge along the main road connecting the city to the tourism belt in Grouzlay had collapsed. Further up the Grouzlay Highway, another bridge at Bois-de-Wanche was damaged by the flood waters. Areas around Castries suffered major rain and flood damage. A massive landslide tore away the road linking Kako to Geno in the Babono constituency, sweeping away five homes in the area. Fortunately, there was no loss of life. As more sunlight peered through highly overcast skies, it slowly revealed a real and frightening picture. Another landslide on the west coast, on the road to Soufrière, would take the life of Sabinus Thomas, one of the island's prominent arts and craft exponents. His son, daughter, and wife also perished, not far from St. Lucia's best-known landmarks. Soufrière Town, the West Coast tourism capital, containing the most visited tourist attractions, was now a picture of devastation. The human tragedy was unimaginable. The interior community of Fonse-Jacques was completely devastated. It was cut off by several landslides. Many homes were destroyed. Lives were lost, including a mother and her two sons, when their home was buried under an avalanche of mud and water. No community was spared. The road structure was unable to withstand the floodwaters and landslides from Hurricane Tomas. The devastation was extensive, and reconstruction will surely be expensive.
In some instances, we speak of communities having to be either redeveloped or new communities developed. And one example is the community of Fonse-Jacques in Soufrière, which has been completely wiped out as a consequence of mudslides and landslides.
The water sector was severely hit. Landslides disrupted major water sources. Water authorities soon announced that all intakes were destroyed, badly damaged, or washed away. Miles of supply mains were buried under landslides, and the John Compton Dam at Roseau, the island's main water source, was disabled.
pump stations were either destroyed, mud-filled, or without electricity. The island's water supply was disrupted. There was no community with potable water in the wake of Hurricane Tomas.
In fact, up to now, we've not been able to restore water supply because of the serious destruction to the actual water infrastructure.
The damage to the island's water infrastructure was extensive, and the cost of repairs would run into several millions of US dollars.
The challenge for us is, while there are rivers that we can draw water from, the amount of landslides that we have, the amount of silt that is washed into these rivers, it will take it a while before the water can get clean enough to even be treated in order to be used.
The water sector needs some serious injection of capital in terms of not just repairing the damage, but building the resilience and strengthening the capacity of the sector to respond to such calamities.
The unavailability of drinking water caused the National Emergency Management Organization, NEMO, to announce a water emergency. The unavailability of clean drinking water exposed the population to waterborne diseases. The entire country was without pipe-borne water. There was no potable water for drinking, cooking, and for cleaning up after the storm, and critically, for general hygiene. The island's leading supermarket chain was without water to clean up its flooded warehouse. Its ability to provide critically needed food supplies was being hampered by its inability to clean away the muck and mud brought down by the flood waters. Hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of goods were damaged in 8 feet of muddy flood waters. Other warehouses suffered similar damage. The island's main health institutions were also affected by flooding. Damaged roofs resulting in water-soaked medical supplies, equipment, and patient facilities. Many homes were lost to the flood waters and several landslides across St. Lucia. Many houses still teeter perilously on the verge of collapse. A major challenge will be to rebuild the homes lost in Soufrière's Fort-Saint-Jacques community. The entire area was evacuated, leaving over 1,000 people homeless. Preliminary reports indicate that the residents may never return to their homes. Some of the emergency shelters are schools, many damaged by Hurricane Tomas through land slippages, flood damage, and in some cases, wind damage. Computers, copiers, and other equipment were lost. The schools themselves require major cleanup operations. The banana industry has been the lifeblood of St. Lucia's economy for generations, and once again, it has suffered a tremendous blow. Banana fields were the first casualties of the hurricane force winds of Tomas. Banana plantations from around the island were leveled, and in the process, have denied the country's farmers and their dependents precious income for many months to come.
Based on our preliminary figures, estimates, we realize that the entire banana industry is affected. We are not in a position right now to export to our traditional market. Greenhouses were destroyed. Irrigation systems were damaged. A lot of farm roads were washed away. In some instances, we would have to realign these roads, and it would be very costly. And to date, as we speak, there are farmers who have not been able to get to the holdings.
Vegetable farms have been wiped out. Poultry farmers have lost thousands of birds, and many livestock were drowned in rising flood waters. St. Lucia's food security has been seriously impacted. Acres of rich agricultural lands were washed away by the flood waters, making any recovery in the agricultural sector extremely challenging. Farmers who have just recovered from a severe drought are now extremely demotivated.
One have to understand, coming from a drought, and a severe drought, after 4 months, coming back into production and being faced with that the hurricane, is really discouraging, and there must be some support to encourage our farmers to get back into production.
Farmers need immediate assistance in jump-starting the seriously impacted agricultural sector.
Question of inputs, fertilizers, seeds, pesticides, the question of financial support, you know, to help them pay for the labor to re-establish, because one have to understand and appreciate when you're re-establishing, the demand for labor is critical.
The communication infrastructure was hit hard by Hurricane Tomas. Main roads in the north were severed in many areas by devastating landslides. West Coast communities were completely isolated. On the East Coast, it was an equally depressing sight. In Bexar, thick muddy waters overflowed riverbanks, overwhelming the main link road to the East Coast and overflowing into homes along the highway. There was extensive property damage. A few miles away, the mountain range linking the north to the east and south experienced severe landslides, cutting off all access to the East Coast. There were massive landslides making it impossible to travel to the east and south coasts of the island. In the Bardolillo, there was a major operation to clear the main road of the thousands of trees brought down by the landslides. Families desperate for news of loved ones, desperate for water and other essentials, were trekking in dangerous conditions up and down the now unstable portion of the Bardolillo. This portion of the East Coast Road, prone to frequent landslides after heavy rains, once again suffered landslide damage, with portions getting washed away, making it almost irreparable in some areas. This is a major challenge to the complete restoration of the island's road network.
It's the terrain that we have to work with, the retaining walls and the bridges that we have to build. So it is really a challenge, and it is going to cost us quite a bit to bring things back to normal in the country.
Because St. Lucia is always going to be in a hurricane path, is always going to be suspect to heavy rains, and the terrain in the Bardolillo shows the vulnerability of this country as it relates to transportation to the international airport and up north.
We saw the implications of the Bardolillo being affected as a consequence of landslides. Immediately upon the closure of the Bardolillo, then we paralyzed the south of the island.
The damage to Soufriere, the west coast town most visited by tourists to the island, will impact significantly on the island's tourism sector. The Caribbean's only drive-in volcano, the Sulphur Springs in Soufriere, suffered severe damage. This was a major income earner for the people of Soufriere. Now it requires major repairs to the access roads, the facilities, and amenities. The picture from Soufriere is not pretty, but there is hope. Soufriere is the tourism capital of St. Lucia. Serious damage there will impact on the tourism industry, which is the island's main income earner. The road infrastructure and water are the biggest challenges to the tourism industry. Without water, tourism establishments will not remain open for business. Some are already reacting.
They're now laying off staff and sending the staff home. So in addition to people losing all their personal effects, they now are staying home. And I think that this could become a potential social crisis if we don't solve this problem very quickly.
With the banana industry severely impacted, tourism remains the only other source of income for St. Lucia.
The banana industry has all but been destroyed. At least we will not be seeing any revenue from the banana industry for the next 10 months. So it means that tourism has to continue to carry the burden.
Recovery will not be easy and will require the commitment and support of local, national, and international agencies. The repairs and rehabilitation works needed are extensive and expensive, but are needed to stave off further human tragedy. The rehabilitation of the water infrastructure is the major priority, and help to alleviate human suffering through the provision of food and shelter is critical. St. Lucia's economy was already severely impacted by the global economic crisis. And now, with Hurricane Tomas inflicting millions of dollars of damage, St. Lucia will need help to rebuild. A detailed impact assessment is being done, and once completed, a donors conference will be convened, during which St. Lucia will outline plans for rebuilding.
So again, it provides an opportunity for us to be able to prepare for the worst in the future. And it will help us in designing our infrastructure, making our infrastructure a lot more adequate.
The government of St. Lucia will be looking to its development partners, the donor agencies, friendly governments, for assistance in financing this major reconstruction and recovery effort.
The government now has spent a tremendous amount of money in clearing roads, bringing in barges in, transporting fuel around the island because these roads had collapsed and we had to reach out to those communities at a time when we're in a recession.
We cannot allow the country to remain stagnant and everything to come to a grinding halt. And we are hoping that the agencies and the friendly countries and governments would come to our aid in this situation because it is really a challenge.
We have received a fair amount of support in kind from a number of organizations and governments already. People have been sending water, in emergency supplies and so on. So I am very hopeful that we will in fact get a fair amount of support.
St. Lucia needs your help in its recovery effort. Bank accounts have been established in St. Lucia and at major centers overseas through which donations can be made. Your contribution will be used in the relief and rebuilding effort needed in many parts of the island.
Everywhere there is crisis, but Soufre is a disaster.
Moye helicopter, let feel force Jacques Lang, but he booked. If I voye let by Timamai, glow, if he be sweet select bagay comme ça.
In Fon Saint Jacques, the mountains have collapsed. Okay. And, Soufre, we have deaths. Sabi's whole family is gone.
Hurricane Tomas came and left in its wake unprecedented damage, fatalities, and in these tough economic times, a monumental challenge to rebuild St. Lucia. But St. Lucia has in the past recovered from natural disasters and will rise again.
Seen this video several times because, of course, I worked closely with the production company, and each time you can't help but begin to appreciate the magnitude of the crisis, and especially when you're at the center of it. We're dealing with housing problems of housing and relocation, people whose incomes have totally disappeared. The agricultural sector, as we have indicated, has been most hard hit. And what do you say to a farmer, 8,500 of them, and we have 3.2 children per family, so do the math. And it's a small population, but 8,500 of those times 3.2, it gives you a sense of the number of people whose lives have been affected, and that is only for one sector. So when we meet with development agencies and we meet with our lending agencies, development partners, and we try to impress upon them the magnitude of this crisis, and all is relatively well in the north of the island, which is where you are right now, but if you were to go to the west coast, and some of you, those of you that have flown in from Viewfort, you would have had to traverse some of the very same roads there, and maybe you would not even have realized that you drove across those roads, because in 2.5 weeks, we have been able to do a massive amount of reconstruction. So I just want us to bear that in mind, and PM said it yesterday, when we speak of vulnerability, imagine one event can completely wipe out one of your key sectors, impact negatively on the second, and it brings the issue of sustainability to the fore, to your table, into your pocket, into your office. This is not a theoretical exercise. We live through each day, especially in this part of the world, the vulnerabilities that can, in fact, impact on the amount of progress that one can make with respect to socioeconomic development. So I thank you for having viewed the video. The good news is, and like we said yesterday, there's a solution spirit that is so resilient that even against all of the odds, we're able to pick up again. And we ask that you continue to pray for us, those families who have lost loved ones, that they can somehow find it within themselves to pick up the pieces and to continue in good faith. So I thank you. We move now into the break, and we resume promptly in 15 minutes as per your schedule. Am I correct? Yes? Yes. So we resume in 15 minutes. The respective, is it a parallel session? No, it's not a parallel session, is it? Okay. It is a parallel? Okay. So can I ask the respective chairs to ensure that all is well with your panels and that you are in charge? I don't have to come running around saying, please resume. I mean, the program speaks for itself. Thank you very kindly. And will all presenters go to the secretariat so the appropriate e-arrangements can be made? Oh, did you?